From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, December the 6th, 2019. We have a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be speaking right off with Paul Heinz, terrific reporter for 7 days, the weekly newspaper and very active website based up in Burlington. They get into a lot of statewide issues, and boy, did they get into one this week. And that is the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility and the apparent behaviors of some of its particularly staff members there. It does not sound like a pleasant place at all for the women inmates who end up there. Of course, jail is not supposed to be pleasant, but when we hear all these stories that Paul Heinz documented this week about sexual abuse and sexual assault, sexual harassment, as well as rampant drug use, apparently, by some staff members, it really paints a pretty bleak picture. And I'm very happy to say that Paul Heinz is my guest on our air this morning to tell us a little bit about what he and his reporting project found. Good morning, Paul.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. I want to congratulate you first off. This is a very dense pile of reporting here. I mean, really thorough, and you clearly spent a lot of time and hard work on this story, and so hats off to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, and I should say that a story like this is only possible when people are willing to talk with you, and I think I was very fortunate to get an initial tip about this, but then to encounter many people, both inmates and officers, who were willing to share their stories, some on the record, some off the record, but all of them I thought were pretty brave to come forward, because they're difficult stories to share, and you know, given that some of the stories are about fears of retribution, certainly I think some of them feared that there would be further retribution if they talked about it.
Yeah, it's tough on the one hand. On the other hand, these issues have sort of been, it seems like, hiding in plain sight for years. And I just think the public in general ought to be really thankful for the fact that we still do have some active journalism in this state and in this country that can dig in every now and then and even address an issue like this that is, you know, it's not really new, unfortunately.
Right.
But it is something that needs to be exposed from time to time. And, you know, and this isn't the first story I've seen in my life about this kind of activity going on in a wide variety of prisons, but for you to bring it to light in this manner at this time is a very important thing, and I'm sad it has to happen, but I'm glad it's happening. So,
well, I heard from a former journalist, a former Vermont journalist, who told me that she was writing stories about this back in the 90s that were not all that dissimilar. And in fact, though this story I think kind of lays out quite a number of pretty alarming cases and situations side by side, as you point out, some of them have been reported before. I mean, not all this information is new. A couple of the former corrections officers who have faced charges, were written about at the time. But I think what may be helpful and new here is putting all of these cases side by side, showing that it's not just a one-off, right? It's not. I think when you see one officer charged every couple of years, you think, oh, maybe that's just a bad apple,
right?
But I think really the story is more about a systemic issue rather than individual action.
No, that's very true. And I mean, you think about a lot of great journalism over the years has been to take the more than one shot approach and have a systematic look at an issue like this. I mean, you think about, sure, there were stories all through the 80s and 90s about the occasional sexually misbehaving priest in the Boston area. And then
right.
when the Globe came out with its Spotlight series in 2002, that's what really moved the issue. And so it's the same kind of phenomenon here. And I got to point that out because I think it's so important. And certainly, under the current federal administration and just in the economy and so on, journalism has taken a beating in the last really decade and recent years as well, a couple decades, and especially in the last couple of years. And as somebody who spent a lot of time toiling in the in the gardens of that particular field, I have to kind of stand up and defend it every now and then, especially when I see a good example of it. So tell us what you found. I mean, this is something that, and I should say also that this thing is really drawing a lot of reaction, although some reaction may be a bit delayed. I've been scrambling around here trying to get a couple of senior state officials to come on my radio this morning in the second half hour of the program to see about what their responses might be to this. And so far, I am...
I'm shocked. shocked to hear that.
People are busy, you know. It's amazing.
there has been. We can talk about the reaction in a moment. Maybe first I'll just sort of lay out what I found here. But the story focuses on, as you said, the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility, which since 2011 has been Vermont's only prison for women. It's in South Burlington. Currently, there are just shy of 140 women who are lodged there, and the story covers really that whole time period and looks at a number of different types of allegations. So there are allegations of sexual harassment and assault against current inmates, against former inmates who are still under DOC supervision, meaning they're on furlough, on probation, on parole, and just to be clear, state and federal law prohibits any kind of sexual relations between a DOC official and a former inmate who is still under DOC supervision, even if he or she is out.
And I want to emphasize that point for a moment because it's very important. You can't have a consensual sexual relationship with somebody who's under your charge in this regard. If you're a corrections officer and you have an inmate there, you know, the two of you can be in any other context in life legitimately in love and wild about each other, et cetera, et cetera. In that context, you got to forget about it.
That's correct. Because of the inherent power differential that is part of that relationship. That's why the law recognizes that and prohibits it, as do DOC rules. So some of the allegations pertain to situations that took place outside of the prison over the years, including in a couple of cases, guards pursuing former inmates after they had left prison. There were also
now. Let me. I hate to keep interrupting, but I think this is a really important point. That's also verboten, right? I mean, you are not supposed to be getting into. You still have a supervisory role over this person, even if she is formerly locked up. Now she's out on probation, and you see her on the street.
That's right. And one specific example that I wrote about is a woman named Melissa Gabry who. After she was released, she's been in and out of prison for the last dozen years or so. While she was out at one point, her probation officer, who works for former probation officer who works for DOC, sent her some pretty lewd messages over Facebook seeking a sexual relationship, and a current DOC guard. Chittenden Regional Guard did the same and attempted to basically showed up at her apartment at 1 a.m. Seeking sexual relationship. And so that's one category. I also wrote about allegations of sexual harassment against female officers within the prison. And then sort of the lead story I wrote about was a particular supervisor, a guy named Daniel Zorzi, who has, according to 13 officers and inmates that I spoke to, has appeared to have been quite high on cocaine and other stimulants while on duty and while at times running the prison on second shift.
Wow.
For years, at least 6 years, maybe longer.
How old is Zorzi?
I actually don't have an age right in front of me, and I should say that he's, he did not, I reached him, he declined to comment.
Yep.
He's not been charged with anything yet. We know that he was suspended from the prison in October, though it does not appear it's because of these long-standing complaints about his alleged drug use. Rather, it was because an inmate filed an even more inflammatory report alleging not just drug use, but sex with former inmates who were still under DOC supervision in July. The Vermont State Police confirmed that they are investigating Mr. Zorzi And we don't know where the police are in that investigation. But
yeah, well, I think that there is a real potential here for problems, and it just seems like as part of the training, these corrections officers get. There's just got to be a real hammering home of essentially ethical requirements here, and this is true in a lot of professions, psychologists and psychiatrists, social workers who are offering therapy to people, they can get into some pretty deep stuff with a client, there is some history in that world of improper sexual relationships and so on, and that's countered with just a lot of care and a lot of training around this stuff about how to avoid these things. In our own field, Paul, I'm sure you've heard in a journalism class or two that reporters are never supposed to get involved with their sources and so on and so forth, and it's just something that is verboten, and I've seen people and heard of cases in our field where people have been fired. I remember there was one famous case back in the 70s where a woman, I think had worked for the Philadelphia Inquirer, got involved with a lawmaker in Harrisburg where she was covering the State House, and then went on to the New York Times and got fired from the Times for her past situation in Pennsylvania. So, it's taken seriously in a lot of fields. It clearly needs to be taken extremely seriously when the person you are dealing with is incarcerated.
Yeah, I would argue it's far more serious in that situation, because when you're incarcerated, you have nowhere to go.
Exactly.
You're in a confined space.
Talk about a captive audience.
Right. That's definitely true. And one thing that I heard, especially from the officers who I interviewed, is that perhaps one of the contributing factors here is that there are not very many requirements for becoming a corrections officer in Vermont. You really just need a high school degree or a GED, you need to go through a background check. But even if you have a criminal background, the commissioner can grant waivers. There are no drug tests for corrections officers, which definitely surprised me. And in fact, at a press conference yesterday, Governor Phil Scott said that he was surprised by that too. He didn't realize that was the case.
No drug tests for corrections officers.
That's correct. There's no. Yeah, I mean, I think that if there's some suspicion of drug use, they can test an officer, but there's no drug test at hiring, nor any kind of regular drug testing. And you would think that given the many reports we've heard over the years of officers bringing in drugs for inmates, that might be something you'd want to be aware of if your corrections officers were regularly using drugs. Another issue that sort of goes hand in glove with the standards is Vermont's really low unemployment rate. And, as with so many professions, so many different organizations, the Department of Corrections has had a really, really hard time finding anyone to work in these prisons. And so they're understaffed. This particular facility is down, I think, like 15 or 17 officers at the moment. That's true throughout DOC. That leads to tons and tons of overtime, which not only is expensive for the state, but it is really tough on these officers. So they're put in a tough position as well. So there are just so many issues here. And just the final thing I want to mention in terms of like the categories that I reported is that of retribution. And this is something that the inmates and officers both described to me, that whenever they spoke out, or often when they spoke out about perceived misconduct, they were punished for speaking out rather than, thanked, right? And so that was the case for many of the officers I spoke to when they reported Zorzi's alleged behavior over the years. They felt like they were being punished for having done so.
For speaking up, yeah. That's the classic whistleblower kind of situation. And again, it is just exacerbated and put even into more sharper relief when you have a situation involving incarceration. I mean, that just really makes everything starker. It's a really bad situation. Sam from Williston is on the line, and good morning, Sam.
Morning. Want to thank you for doing this story. I got a couple of questions, actually, but before I get to that, I think you only hit the tip of the spear here. This goes all the way up through the federal system, where we're really falling down on these people that we're incarcerating, how this all works. Within the state, I do believe once you're in the system, they don't want you out of the system. You now become a chip for being used to keep them basically in a job. We need to look at this. We've gone about this all wrong. Can I ask you one question? What was this woman originally put into the system for?
Are you talking about Melissa Gabbri, who I mentioned before?
Yes.
So my understanding is that it was an alleged hate crime when she was around 16 years old. But I think, to your point, she has largely been in jail over these years for parole violations, for being on furlough and running away and that sort of thing. And, I take your point. I think it is true that, in many of the cases that I became aware of in reporting this story, that the incarcerated women were, really hadn't committed much of a crime recently. It was the crime was not being able to comply with the terms of release, and that does seem to be pretty prevalent both here.
And once again, if that's your work, and you get yourself an SUV and all the other trappings of the job, you want to probably keep your clientele. And for the most part, this is their clientele. I think, especially when you're telling me this young lady was 16 years old when she gets into the system and has been entrapped in the system for how many years?
Yeah, Sam, you make a really good point, and I appreciate the call, but I got to move on. I think that is thanks for the call, Sam. Paul, I have heard about that. The system, once it has its hooks into you, it's really hard to escape. And I wonder if there's going to be. I really want to spend the last few minutes here of our segment together, actually asking you, what are you hearing about possible solutions? I know you talked to a national group which was talking about this being a rampant problem across the country. It has been addressed in other places. Clearly, there are some facilities that are handling this stuff way better than it appears ours is here in Vermont. And so I know it's only been, 48 hours out. This has only been out about 48 hours now. But I wondered, what are you hearing initially from state officials about approaches to fixing the problem?
Well, there's been a long-running debate, of course, about whether we should be jailing as many people here in Vermont and around the country. And I think that I suspect that this story will become part of that debate in Vermont, that advocacy groups who want to close down prisons here or at least avoid building new ones will say this is one reason why. That's a broader question. Mm-hmm. More specifically about this facility in the Department of Corrections, what has happened since publication is that the governor called on his newly appointed Secretary of Human Services, who oversees the Department of Corrections, called on Mike Smith to, your predecessor, I guess I should mention,
right.
to conduct a review over the next few weeks of what happened here, and if he can corroborate what I found, to take some sort of unspecified action, either DSC or specifically at Chittenden Regional. We don't know what that's going to look like. We also know that Attorney General T.J. Donovan reached out to the governor yesterday and pledged his support for whatever kind of investigation is necessary. We know that Sarah George, the Chittenden County State's Attorney, responded to the story by basically pledging to review the sentences of all of the women her office has sent to Chittenden Regional. That number is somewhere around 20. And so what she wants to do is find out why these women are there and determine whether any of them should be released early. And if so, she's going to advocate for their early release.
Yep, yep.
That's, again, just Chittenden County prisoners.
By the way, you alluded to Mike Smith from a moment ago, and Mike happens to be a small world of Vermont, of course. the previous occupant of this chair here on the WDEV 911 talk slot. And
sorry, so if you don't do a good job on the radio, they make you clean up the Department of Corrections.
Oh my God, I better sharpen my act here.
Seriously,
but I got to say, Mike's got. I did reach out to him this morning. He's got a very legitimate reason for not being able to join me this morning, and is promising to do so next week. I'm not sure exactly what day yet, but I suspect we will be following up with the newly reinstalled. He was there years ago, back in 2005 or so, for a while. Human Services Secretary, and Governor Scott just last couple months appointed Mike to that job he had had once before, and so he's a man of many talents, and clearly is going to be in a hot one. He is in a hot one right now, and so going to be reaching out to Mike for an appearance on the show next week, and I suspect we'll be able to arrange that. The I just think, you know, in terms of the possible solutions here, are people starting to think about maybe needing to drug test corrections employees?
Well, that came up at the press conference yesterday with Governor Scott. He didn't commit to that, but it did seem to me like he thought that might make sense. He specifically said he wanted to see what other states do. I've only done cursory research on this, but it does appear that many states do require drug tests for corrections officers.
It seems like one of those categories. I mean, even if you're sort of liberal on this stuff and don't favor blanket drug testing, nuclear plant operators, long-haul truck drivers, school bus drivers maybe, and probably corrections officers would be four professional categories you would think might be first in line, but I don't know. Hey, Paul Heinz, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning, and thank you again for some excellent, excellent work on this story. It's a really, really good 7 days of supporting you in this, so thanks
a
lot.
And any listeners, feel free to send us tips to prisons@7daysvt.com.
There you go. Thanks again, Paul.
Thanks, Dave.
Going to go to some bottom of the hour news here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
This is Jack from the Warren Store, wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season, and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker, and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants, and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, continuing into the second half hour of our Friday morning show, this December 6th, 2019. And boy, there is a lot going on these days in the news, both nationally and here in the state of Vermont. Just had, if you missed, Paul Heinz on for the first half hour of the Dave Graham Show here in WDEV FM and AM. And if you did miss, this is a good reason to check out our podcast, because Paul Heinz of 7 Days had a terrific story this week, a really unhappy story, but one in a very important story, I should say. Guarded Secrets is the headline. It's all about the problems at the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility, Vermont's only prison for women. And a lot of these women are being treated. You don't expect prison to be a fun place for anybody. It's not supposed to be, but there are a lot of stories about sexual harassment, sexual abuse, rape, other really serious problems, including drug use by staff in this facility in South Burlington. And Paul Heinz did a great job of collecting up a lot of stories from people who've been through that system and have come to understand that. It's worse than it's made out to be. You know, nobody wants to go to prison. One of the reasons that they exist, I think, is to be the hell no one wants to visit, and that's what keeps a lot of people on the straight and narrow and out of crime, because of the fear of having to go to a very bad place. But when you take a very bad place and make it a lot worse in unofficial ways, I think that there is a real problem there, and one which our state officials are going to need to address. Certainly not unique to Vermont, but you expect that some of these social problems that we see across America are not going to be so bad here. And maybe this isn't the worst, but it's certainly didn't get a a happy picture painted of it in this story by Paul Hines of 7 Days this week. And hoping to follow up with some state officials next week. Mike Smith, the Agency of Human Services Secretary, was telling me this morning he couldn't come on our air today, but he just had some other stuff going on. But he is telling me he's very likely to be available next week. We'll be reaching out to him again probably later today to try to set up a day for the coming week to hear from the person who oversees a lot of actually tough parts of state government come under the Human Services umbrella. The Department of Corrections is far from the only one. You have the Department of Mental Health, the Department for Children and Family Services, which is the agency which is sometimes forced to remove children from troubled homes. Obviously, usually a very, very fraught situation right there. And many of these issues overlap. You'll have the same families which are having encounters with several of these different human services sub-departments. And so it's a tough situation, and you just feel like, or at least I do, and I wonder what our listeners out there think, and you're welcome to call us. My sense is that too often people end up getting into these certain categories of experience and of sort of station in life that I used to think of them not in my own mind, but as if they were labeled by society in general as kind of throwaway people. Throwaway people would be those who had been in a wide variety of unfortunate situations in life and were being essentially continually kind of run over. And boy, when you hear these stories about women who are being pursued sexually by corrections staff after their release from the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility, the story about a corrections officer showing up at someone's house at 1 a.m. basically looking for sex, and this is not what that person needed in her life at that moment, for sure. That is something that the idea, the word corrections implies we're trying to help people get their lives back together, and this just sounds like, frankly, piling on more damage. And it's really, it's an unhappy situation. I don't know whether it's clearly more tax money that needs to be raised to throw these social problems, or whether it's a better hiring practices by the state government. Exactly what the answer is here. But in fact, if anybody has any thoughts out there, I'd love to hear them, because I think, and I'm sure some of our state officials would as well, these are difficult problems. I'm not saying they're easy to solve, but they are. This is where, in a democracy, you hope members of the public are thinking about this stuff as citizens, coming up with their own ideas, and maybe starting with a letter to the editor, a call to their local legislator, a call to a radio program like the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM can sometimes get an interesting and useful thought into circulation. So 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. And if you would like to check in with us, you are more than welcome to weigh in here. I have reached out to a few different folks to see whether we might get them on the phone during this half-hour segment of the Dave Graham Show, where we didn't have a full locked-in guest for this morning. I usually like to leave a little part of the show open, at least a couple, maybe 3 days a week, to allow folks to check in with us and let us know what's on your minds. Obviously, there's been a lot of other news as well this week, mainly, I guess, the big story out of Washington. Of course, the House Judiciary Committee had its hearing on Wednesday, where they brought in some constitutional scholars to talk about the requirements of the presidency and whether some of these have been violated by President Trump to a degree which requires impeachment. And of course, the big news yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi coming out and saying, yes, she has concluded that is the case and that it is time to move forward with drafting articles of impeachment. It appears that's going to be happening by Christmas. This over the objections, some Republicans are arguing that this is all happening too fast, the evidence is too thin, etc. I have my own misgivings, which I've voiced on the show previously, about just thinking that maybe it would be smart to take a little more time, get a couple of courts to rule in favor of requiring administration officials to come in and testify, who've so far been refusing to do so, get a couple of court rulings to require that the administration deliver some documents that are being demanded by the Congress. And so far, those demands have been met with refusals as well. In other words, move the process along a little farther, build up even more of a case. I think the case already exists, as apparently Speaker Pelosi does. But you can always stand to have more of a case when you're going into a trial, especially one that's going to be in the Senate under Republican control, where a lot of folks are pretty much geared up right off the bat to not have an impartial trial, but to have something that would be essentially a guaranteed exoneration or acquittal of the President of the United States. Let's hear it. We do have a caller on the line. Let's go to Dave in Plainfield. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Dave. A few quick points on here. First of all, Vermont's the only state that convicted felons run the jails. Let's get to second point. The law, I've got the newspaper clipping to prove it, because I've done radio for years, and I tell people things on here like you do, and they say, tell me you're making this up. I have the Burlington Free Press from about 2006 or 7 headline stating that they just passed a law saying the guards and prisoners couldn't have sex. Okay? It didn't happen until 2007. And I was told when the Springfield jail, the first year the Springfield jail opened, there was approximately one a month, 16 guards, all female guards, fired because for having or attempting to have sex with prisoners. Now, the fourth thing I like to say is I just got off parole for, I've been arrested my whole life for possession of pot 16 times in this county, and I've done radio for 35 years here, and I first went to jail in New York in 1968 for possession of pot. So I've been through the system in five different states and five decades and all this. And the biggest problem I saw in St. John's, where I was in 2007, the biggest change was this Title IX business, and it's just, you read the New York papers, what's going on. All men in the men's jail, all women in the women's jail. Now, you got women guards in the men's jail, and this turns into real problems, okay? I'm just saying, this is not jail as I know it. And I'm just saying, I saw this as a mess. I don't want to get into all the details. I'm trying to write anecdotes. I got somebody typing this for me because I'm old and poor now, and it's called Tales of the Jails, like I said. I've got all kinds of wild things that are just nuts. I guess it's time for this to come out, okay? But I've been doing this for a while, and I'm not a writer. I'm a talker and a piano player, so I have someone helping me. But people got to know this stuff. It starts with the judicial system. And the fact that we have no grand juries. And I've yelled on my radio show about this for years. Some side judges have picked up. You have to have a grand jury to decide whether or not someone is being charged with a felony. When I first called in the 70s, called the head of the Bar Association in New York State, Dave, George Nyberg, and I told him, because he was a patient of my father's, that what happened to me over here is a ridiculous story where the police came into, I just moved here, and the police wandered into my building with a search warrant for stolen chicken and somebody else's name on it for a green building, and this whole nutty story. And he told me, David, are you making this up? Why are you bothering me? No. And I told him, no, you have to have a grand jury. What are you talking about? My lawyer friends in Connecticut laughed at me when I said there's no grand juries. All we have is one page. People have researched it, but it starts with that. And then I could go on and on. We did not have a means to discipline a lawyer in this state, and I have the letter to prove it, until 1989. I got a letter from the Supreme Court because I filed a complaint, and we have no permanent means, and we're just putting bar counsel, and your case will be one of the first to hurt. Dave, this is ridiculous, so I'm going to tell you. So who'd they put in charge of this new ethics board, right, or whatever? A woman that was sitting on my school board at the time, who happened to be the wife of a sitting district court judge. I can't tell you names. I won't tell names on the air. I'll tell you in private. But this is what I'm telling you is not on Channel 3, and it's not in the papers. It's in Cendron's files. My name's Cendron, and I've collected, and I tell people in other states this. They're horrified.
Hey, Dave, I'll tell you what.
You're
jumping around quite a bit here, and I don't think anybody's really following these shards of stories you're telling, some of which sound like they're pretty interesting. But I would say that if you want, send me an email at here at the station. You can look up wdevradio.com and find my email on the website here and spell out a couple of these things in a little more detail.
Well, you got to get the women out of the men's jails and vice versa. That's the way we did it in the old
days. That's the bottom line for today. All right, Dave. Hey, thanks for the call. I got to go, but I appreciate it. And, wow, that was a pretty exciting ride there, folks. I mean, I'm sure that's, you know, there's a lot of real information there. It's just a matter of sorting it out and trying to slow it down enough that I can get a grip, which didn't really happen on that one. But, hey, we're going to go to some top of the hour news here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. We're going to be hearing about some climate change legislation being developed by a couple of leading lawmakers when we get into our second hour this morning. We're also going to be hearing from our good friend Bob Ney, get his thoughts on what's happening in Washington just after the top of the hour. So stay with us, folks. Full second hour coming up.
This is Jack from the Warren Store wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Continuing into our second hour on this December 6th, Friday morning, 2019. Wow, December 6th. That means there's really only a couple of weeks left until Christmas for those who celebrate the holiday. I'm sure my good buddy Dana Jewell here in the booth here has all of his Christmas shopping done already. He's giving me one of those, yeah. And what do you think, Dana? You all set?
Yeah, my wife always says, you only have one thing to get. She does the rest. I just find something for her.
Well, I wish you luck with that. I know
the road we go.
Yeah, that's it. Hey, I got a good guest for the next few minutes here. Our good friend Bob Ney is on the line from the great environs of, where are you, Bob?
I am today in the great state of Ohio.
Okay. I suspected that might be the case since that was your longtime home and a home district when you served in the United States Congress. But you keep your eagle eye on many of our national events from wherever you are, and that's always a good thing.
Yes, I venture out to that city and try to get out as quick as I can out of D.C., but
yeah.
I do this.
I get you. I understand why that might be the case. But hey, I wanted to check in with you because obviously big doings this week. Nancy Pelosi is, I guess, pulling the trigger. Is that the way to describe it, or how would you describe it?
Well, she is, and you know, originally the speaker didn't want to go towards impeachment. I think the Ukraine call and some of the revelations about that created a situation where she needed to do it because the majority of her caucus wanted to do it. Now, at one point in time, months ago, she said, well, it needed to be bipartisan. Well, these things aren't necessarily always bipartisan. So, you know, there's going to be a decision made. You might have a couple of Democratic members who will vote to not impeach or will vote present, which sometimes people do that. We call it going to the duck pond, but they do.
Yeah.
And, but otherwise, it's going to be, you know, obviously overwhelmingly Republican. Democrat. There's a couple of Republican members, one from Florida, that was talking about it, but we'll see. But the speaker made it clear yesterday, this is it, okay? She believes this should happen, and the House is going to have a vote.
Yep. Well, I was saying just a few minutes ago on the show here, she's not listening to me. I've been urging. I actually thought that Turley made some sense. Jonathan Turley, the Republican lawyer, spoke at the Judiciary Committee hearing 2 days ago, because that was such a long time ago, this way this story goes. He was saying that the evidence is still a little thin and that the Democrats are rushing this. And I think the Democrats would have been well within their rights to say, yeah, well, let's wait for Pompeo to show up and let's wait for Mulvaney to show up and Rudy Giuliani, you know. And when they don't show up, finally, by next July, then they can launch. Then they can have their final denouement and handing off to the Senate of the impeachment recommendations by maybe that first day of the week of the Republican National Convention. You know, that would be an interesting bit of timing and so on. But
I think that they should have extended it, in my opinion, at least until they could force Rudy Giuliani to come in, because to me, he's a jackpot witness.
Yeah.
And that would have presented a problem for Giuliani because he doesn't have executive protection, you know, privilege, which the president's been invoking. He's a private citizen.
Yeah.
So I think that they should have, always did think towards the end of this when I saw how much Giuliani's role is, because, you know, he's over in the Ukraine now, which is bizarre, but they should have drug him in.
What about attorney-client privilege? Does he have that?
I don't think so in this case because, you know, first, this is an impeachment, and number two, if the president had, you know, and confided to him a certain legal fact, but the president has a wide legal team, so he didn't serve as attorney for the president on this issue. Now, if he does admit he served as attorney for the president on this issue, then I think he has some reporting problems of what he's doing in the Ukraine. So I think either way that Giuliani probably has more problems than most people whose names have been brought up in this entire thing.
Yeah, I think the proper metaphor is probably somewhere between a three-dimensional tic-tac-toe and threading a needle. I don't know if you can thread a three-dimensional needle, but Giuliani is really—he's gotten himself into quite a pretzel of a situation, it seems to me. But I don't know.
He was a fantastic mayor, well liked, et cetera, prosecutor, and then after he got out of office, and then he went towards the private sector. He actually had a history, for example, being on the payroll for the Mojahideen Khalq, which was a terrorist group at the time, and he received $150,000 from them promoting their issues. And when I saw that, I thought, what are you doing that for? You know, the mayor of New York, in particular, former mayor. So I think money has probably, you know, influenced him, and that's what he was doing in the Ukraine.
The root of all evil, I think I've read somewhere. It was money. Yeah. So, I don't know. I think that so he should be called in. And I didn't mean to sound overly snarky or cynical there. I probably did sound overly snarky or cynical. But really, I do think it's a legitimate goal if the Democrats had decided to set it of bringing in Rudy Giuliani. And frankly, it's legitimate to bring in Pompeo, Mulvaney, and Bolton. Even though they're under orders by the president, because a lot of the constitutional scholars that have been speaking out in the last couple of days, including a very interesting conversation we had here with John Hughes, professor just retiring from St. Michael's College, political science guy, but his field is the Constitution. And he was making the argument quite clearly that the real problem here, the bigger problem than asking Ukraine to influence our elections or allowing Russia to influence our elections, or whatever, the biggest problem that Hughes sees, and I've heard this from others on the national scene as well, is this idea that the president is really trying to lay down a marker that essentially he can, quote-unquote, do anything I want. That's the old King George, the version, King George III version of executive power. And
you make a great point, and I believe at some point in time when the smoke clears on all of this either way and the election occurs either way, I think the Congress would behoove itself before an incoming president, be it Trump again or somebody else, behoove itself to clarify, you know, which they can do, this power, or challenge it through the courts. Because right now, if you got a president that says, nope, I don't have to.
Yeah, and if you regard that as really the biggest problem here, then I think it really does kind of behoove the Democrats, frankly, to wait until they get a couple more court rulings on this point. And so when I talk about, you know, actually having the denouement or the climax of their story come the week of the Republican convention, I mean, that sounds like I'm sort of being a little clever or something. But I think some delay here wouldn't be altogether bad. Another strategic reason, not just to throw a bomb during the Republican convention, but if you're going to have a trial in the Senate, what are Amy Klobuchar and Bernie Sanders and Cory Booker and the other cast of, it seems, a thousands senators running for the Democratic presidential nomination? What are they going to do about the February and March primaries and caucuses and all that stuff?
Well, by the time that happens, I think it's only going to be two senators anyway, which is Warren and Sanders.
And Sanders,
side, and Buttigieg and Biden, you know, unless Biden's going to challenge somebody else to do some push-ups and some other things.
Well,
wow.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that there's actually all sorts of potential for strange, schedule conflicts and and other problems here. But, right. you know, we'll see what unfolds. Obviously, you can't accurately predict the future. And as I say, Speaker Pelosi now has thrown down the gauntlet and said, okay, I was earlier dragging my feet and not convinced at all, but now I'm convinced and let's go for it. And that's the word from the speaker. And boy, when the speaker speaks, she carries a lot of weight for a small statured person.
She does. Nancy Pelosi, I served with her. She's been around a long, long time, has a lot of allies, has built up a lot of friends, and frankly, not that many enemies in the Democratic side.
Yeah.
You know, because Newt, I served with Newt Gingrich, and he built up some enemies, you know. And,
yeah.
But Pelosi's a little bit different. She has got pretty supportive caucus. I mean, there's been some challenges to her, but, you know, nothing where it came close to taking her out.
Right, for sure, for sure. All right, well, Bob Ney, I think we could we'll have to visit again all about this next week. And meanwhile, I wish you a good weekend. Thank you very much.
You too.
All right. So let me formally introduce my two guests, Representative Sarah Copeland-Hanzis, Democratic Bradford. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having us.
And Christopher Pearson, so glad you could make it in as well. Have you caught your breath from the climb up the stairs yet?
Sure have. Thanks, Dave.
Okay, that's good. And so let's start with you, if we could, Sarah Copeland-Hanzis, Representative for Bradford. What have you been up to?
Well, the Climate Solutions Caucus got to adjournment last year and felt like we wanted to have a little different process of putting forward legislation that would get Vermont on the right track to meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals. And so we started right out within a week of when we adjourned last year with an all-day meeting to gather caucus members together and really get a sense of how caucus members wanted to develop a platform for 2020. And from that all-day retreat, we set about with three working groups who were going to work focused on policy, focused on three areas primarily, one being transportation, because we know that that is a significant portion of the greenhouse gas emissions that Vermonters have. One focused on the green economy and renewable energy, because we know that there's a lot of potential for job creation and energy independence that will come out of our focus on good renewable energy policy. And then the third working group really focused on building efficiency, because, of course, our homes and our buildings are also a great use of greenhouse gas. A great emitter of greenhouse gases, and we need to focus on how to help Vermonters transition into more efficiency and renewable energy in that realm as well. So those three policy working groups met virtually or in person throughout the summer, and we gave them a September 1st deadline to come back with recommendations. And the cool thing is that, you know, what they came back with was a set of about 30 pages of ideas and recommendations of things that we can do to help Vermonters save money, be more efficient, and transition towards renewable energy for heating and transportation. And so we have put that together into a set of four banner bills, and then another smaller set of initiatives that can go into bills that are that move on their own in the legislature. Not that we're initiating them, writing them, and putting them forward, but they can, you know, there's little bits that can get tucked into different bills. And so since mid-October, we've been on the road and really getting out and talking to Vermonters about these ideas, because we know it's important to engage with our neighbors on what the climate solutions look like and how we're going to all pull together to make it happen.
You mentioned about 30 pages worth of recommendations from these three sort of subcommittees that met during the summer. Is there a website or someplace folks can go if they want to look at this stuff?
Not really. I mean, we're a citizen legislature. We have no staff. And so it's, you know, it's Chris and me bouncing, you know, a Google document back and forth to try to compile all of the ideas that are coming from our constituents. But interestingly enough, a lot of these community meetings that we're having are also generating ideas. You know, people are saying, you know, have you thought about this? Or why doesn't Vermont do that? And so, you know, we're really still in the gathering phase. And, you know, if we had an administrative assistant who could compile those into a public document, that would be a lot easier for us to really publish that out there. But we're talking about it. We're engaging with people out, you know, in small groups. And I think our head count so far is that we've had almost 800 Vermonters come out to some of these meetings and really have a chance to kick the tires, so to speak.
I'm not going to mention any names, but I bet you I can think of a couple of media organizations who would probably help you compile that information and put it out on their own website and say, here's what these folks are, you know, here's the 30 pages worth of information, maybe boiled down to some summary form or something. But that would be one way to get that out there, because I think there's a lot of sense from just folks I talk to on the street and so on, maybe who haven't followed this. They're following it peripherally. They're trying to follow impeachment. They're trying to follow all the other stuff going on in the world right now. And they're saying, well, these lawmakers are up to something related to the climate, but I don't really know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So that's just one random thought right there. But what were we going to say, Chris Pearson?
Well, we are actually discussing whether or not we could pull together a really simple website that mm-hmm. people could use as a conduit. We do have a Facebook page, Vermont Climate Caucus is how you'd find that, VT Climate Caucus. And, you know, but there again, it's been sporadic. But I think whether or not how we update it. There are partners, VNRC, VPIRG, 350, you know, all sorts of groups that are helping us, and we help them. And, you know, our agendas are not identical by any stretch, but they're watching what we're doing and can help Vermonters follow along. So, you know, this is tricky. If I had staff, I would dedicate it to making sure this communication was more straightforward. But we are all cognizant of the need. And one of the cool things that's come out of these discussions is, absence the substance, which has been very interesting, is a desire that's virtually universal. And people say, how do we stay involved? How do we help?
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
you know, so we take that very seriously. It's very heartening, by the way. But also, we are trying to figure out how do people stay engaged and help us through. This is unlike other policy debates, whatever it is, where you sort of have passed this bill, we get this bill across, GMO labeling, we get this across the board, and then we're good. You know, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a series of year after year taking bites out to get at this challenge. And hopefully we can do that quickly enough to honor the emergency and with enough significance to curb our emissions and strengthen our economy as we go. I mean, this is an unusual challenge. That's why it's been so hard to get our hands around.
So you had some recommendations cooked up by the September 1st deadline, and then you hold this series of meetings around the state. And Sarah, you were saying that you heard some very interesting stuff and some ideas. I'm going to ask each of you to give me your gee, I hadn't thought of that moment, if you can, or something you heard at one of these public meetings, which maybe injected something new.
Yeah, so they kind of run the gamut from really big ideas to really, you know, sort of, oh, wow, that makes a whole lot of sense. You know, for instance, one of the communities that we visited said, why aren't we teaching climate science in schools? Why, you know, why can't we make sure that the next generation of young people who are, you know, coming up through high school and about to graduate have a base level of knowledge of the science behind this so that when they enter the workforce or when they go to college, they're ready to figure out the solutions that we're going to need in the future, whether those solutions be technologies to help us with our heating and transportation, or whether those solutions are how do we sequester carbon? How do we take carbon out of the atmosphere? So, you know, one of the ideas was why don't individual communities put a priority around climate education in you know, middle school and high school?
I guess I have a two-word question just quickly to follow. I know you want to jump in, Chris, but it goes like this. They don't? I mean, I remember I took earth science, I think, in ninth grade.
Yeah.
And we learned things like, you know, the atmosphere, I don't remember the percentages, but there's some percentage carbon dioxide, some percentage oxygen, some percentage nitrogen, et cetera, and how these and other elements interact and so on and so forth. And I would think that is just, you'd have at least a unit these days in a sort of earth science kind of class that would just be part of every science curriculum.
Yeah, you would talk about this. And the teacher that I spoke to in my own community back in Fairley and West Fairley said, that she talks to some of her colleagues from around the state who teach in schools where it's sort of seen as being overly political, and therefore we can't touch that. But
wow.
This is a science curriculum,
so
we kind of need to embrace science.
Chris, what were you going to say?
Well, I just want to follow up. One of the cool ideas I heard the other day out of the Bristol meeting was a gentleman stood up and said, you know, why should Bristol pay another dime for electricity when we could install a solar array and meet our own electric needs in our community, for the school, and for downtown? And he said the answer is money. And why wouldn't we allow some of us who are nearing retirement, who have some money, who, if he said, this is kind of his phraseology, if you're lucky enough to have a financial advisor, they're telling you towards the end of your career to invest conservatively. He said, mm-hmm. I'd like to invest my money in municipal bonds so that my town could invest in a solar array, and we could take that off the property tax for our schools. You know, that the whole room was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, so these are the kinds of things. And what I find heartening about this is that's part of what we're trying to spark here, is getting ideas out. I mean, people turn to the legislature, and in some of these meetings, they're like, this is barely enough what you're suggesting we do. And we acknowledge that. But also, you can't put the whole thing on Montpelier's back. I mean, we need to do this at municipal level. We need to do it at our community level. We need to do it in our faith communities. We need to do it at work. You know, on and on and on. If we were going to get serious about meeting Paris goals and drastically reducing our emissions, it's sort of an all hands on deck moment.
One of the key words in the phrase participatory democracy is participatory.
Yeah.
So, I do think that there's actually some interesting energy, no pun intended, being developed along these fronts. I mean, you see it come bubbling up out of our schools. You know, obviously, Greta Thunberg from Sweden gets all the headlines, but a lot of our students here in Vermont are also starting to say,
absolutely,
we need to kick it into gear as well on this. Well, there's a lot to talk about here. We have got to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news in just a moment, but I want to get into some of these, as you call them, Sarah Copeland-Hanzis, representative from Bradford, banner bills and maybe what's coming up on the agenda. It's got to be well into formation at this point because, as we say, less than a month away, we'll be into the thick of it over there under the dome. So let's get back to that conversation after we go to some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors here at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back, folks. Stay with us.
This is Jack from the Warren Store, wishing you all a happy and healthy holiday season and asking all of you to shop local, eat local, and visit local. The days ahead are getting darker and it looks like winter is finally here. Give yourself the gift of a stress-free life by shopping, eating, and visiting local. Visit your friends, businesses, and restaurants and support their passion and performance. I know that they would love to see you. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, continuing our conversation about the work of something called the Legislative Climate Solutions Caucus, a large group of Vermont lawmakers who've been traveling around the state in the last few months, trying to come up with a way to draft legislation and move the ball and get Vermont to start really pushing hard on this climate change issue, which is, according to some folks, a lot of folks actually, a potentially existential threat, certainly for the way we have conducted human society for the last 150 years or so, with post-industrial revolution and all that sort of thing. Let's hear what listener Pat from Randolph has to say. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
What's on your mind?
I'm just wondering if this whole investigation or tour is being done on a bipartisan basis, and that the Republicans and the administration are being involved from the beginning, which seems like a good idea.
What do you think? What can you tell us, Sarah Copeland-Hanses?
Absolutely. I can tell you that very intentionally over the course of the summer and fall, as we've been in these work groups and planning this outreach, we've kept very much in touch with all of the caucus leadership in the House and the Senate. And I personally called each of the caucus leaders, so the Democratic leader, the Progressive leader, and the Republican leader, and I also reached out individually to independents in the House. So, you know, we really welcome all people who want to participate in the Climate Solutions Caucus and welcome their involvement in developing legislation. And so we definitely have been doing our best to include people in whatever way they want to be included.
Have they been responding, particularly the Republicans, since Pat asked about Republicans?
Yeah. We don't currently have any Republicans who are members of the Climate Solutions Caucus. We've had a few Republican legislators come to the regional meetings, and I think that's really helpful for them to come and participate, and we're happy to have them be a part in that way, even if they're not declared members of the Climate Solutions Caucus.
And the more inclusiveness or interest on all sides that we have in the beginning, the easier it's going to be to actually accomplish something.
Yes, and we've reached out to the governor. We will sit down with the governor sometime in the next couple of weeks before session starts. And, you know, it's my hope that we can find some common ground. And I know that there are some areas where the solutions that we're looking at are things that the governor should be able to get on board with.
Pat, do you think there's any responsibility on the part of Republicans themselves to become more involved in this kind of stuff?
Do I think that?
Yeah.
Certainly, there's only one Earth, so...
Yeah, you know, and this reminds me actually a little bit of a conversation I heard during the Judiciary Committee hearing in Washington the other day where Jonathan Turley and a couple of the Republican members of the committee were talking about how this is totally partisan and that the Republicans haven't come on board at all, and there's no Republicans on board at all with the idea of pursuing this impeachment inquiry and now impeachment, I guess, et cetera. And I remember thinking to myself, I bet you the Democrats would welcome them. So
I'm not blaming anybody. I think the more inclusive you get at the beginning, the easier it is to develop solutions.
Yep, got it. Thanks for the call, Pat. Appreciate it. And do you feel like this is, Chris Pearson, let me ask you, since you have worn a couple of different party hats from time to time, progressive Democrat at least, is this a partisan thing, or is this something that is going to break down that way over time? Do you hope or fear?
I fear it is a partisan thing. It's a science thing, you know, which is not, does not respect party lines, and nor should it. And I hope that our reaction to science is not a partisan thing. It has felt that way, but, you know, let's give the governor credit. He said right out of the gate when the Trump administration signaled they were withdrawing from Paris, the governor said Vermont's going to do its part. We're going to live up to that agreement, joined, I don't know, a dozen other governors around the country saying that. So we're going to welcome him to this and assume that he's supportive of common sense solutions that are good for our economy and good for reducing emissions.
Now, I sense some frustration, actually, because they're what I've been, in fact, I read, a comment or two in one of the stories I read on this just in the last couple of days as we were talking about having you guys on today. I'm going to paraphrase here, but it was sort of like people have been talking about the climate as a real emergency and the need for changes and the need for Vermont to take a leadership role, and et cetera. But not much has been happening in the legislature and in their whole process, whether it's the legislature or the governor, in the last year or two. What have been the chief failings? And I'm going to ask each of you to weigh in. What, in your regard, Chris Pearson, what are we missing so far?
Well, what are we missing? We're missing the collective will to be really aggressive enough to match the urgency that the science is demanding. And part of that is just sort of human nature. I mean, I think you see that at all facets of our state, not just in the legislature, but in communities, in families. You know, we're all increasingly aware of this, increasingly worried about it, noticing the news in a more intense way, and of course our young people speaking up very clearly, but making the necessary investments has been slow, and the policy changes. But that said, you know, as we field questions in these forums, a lot of the questions that come up, the truth and the answer ends up being, well, in fact, last year we kicked off a study to help us understand just exactly how we might look at vehicle registration, you know, a sliding scale. So if you get an efficient station wagon, you're paying a little less than if you get a very inefficient station wagon, you know. So there is a lot underway. I don't want to just suggest we've been asleep. We last year put a 50% increase in our weatherization budget. You know, that stuff comes difficult. It's tough. But, you know, that means we're spending about $17 million on weatherization. We actually need to be spending $40 million. So this is where it gets.
It's that sliding scale thing, and it's always a matter of degree, and it's a matter of not just will, but also resources and what the competition is for those resources. Sarah, what would you say we've been missing on this stuff in the last year or two?
Well, climate change is big, and you alluded to this before, that it means sort of a fundamental shift in the way our economy has functioned for the last 150 years to be thinking about how we transition to using renewable energy sources. And I think the thing that's been lacking is sort of the vision of where we want to get to and the vision of how we're going to get there. And it's really hard to tackle big systemic change like this when you don't have a vision of where you want to go. And it gets easy for people to divide and say, you know, that's not the answer because they don't see how it takes us where we want to go.
You know, I think I just want to interject this because this is something that's been occurring to me more and more recently on this topic, which is that 150-year period, really, of the industrial and post-industrial age here in really the Western world. I think a lot of people get in their car in the morning and turn the key, and the internal combustion engine revs up, and they pull out of their driveway and they drive to work the same route every day. I think it's been that way forever.
Yeah.
Right. You know? And it's funny because, you know, we've got to get out of the mindset that the internal combustion engine is like the pinnacle of human ingenuity. That's not the end point. We can actually do better.
We could be in the very beginning stages of learning how to transport ourselves.
Dave, one of the things that I think about that may or may not be useful, but when I think about a home project that mm-hmm. I've got, the ones that I've never done before, I put off. Right? They're
yeah.
just like, oh, I know I got to deal with X, mm-hmm. but I don't really know how to do it. And so you put it off, you put it off, you put it off. Or if it's a really big project,
yeah.
you tend to put it off. And you know, I remember when we bought our house, the woman prior to us had the entire backyard was a garden. And that was way unmanageable for us. And we let it go for a whole summer. And in the fall, my wife and I went to tackle it. And we didn't know if this was like a week-long project or a couple hours. Mm-hmm. But by the time we had spent an hour, we realized, oh, we can do this all today.
Yeah.
I kind of think that's where we are with the legislature. And part of what Sarah and I and the whole Climate Solutions Caucus have been trying to do is come up with significant policies that are achievable. And I think part of what we could accomplish here, in addition to the policy changes, is proving to the legislature, to our colleagues, and to the state, we can tackle this. We can do this. We have to demonstrate that it's not hopeless. We can make solutions. We can come at this together. And we've been kind of avoiding it because it's really overwhelming and scary, and we've never done it before. And I think that that's sort of where we're at this moment. And I just want to say, somebody pointed this out to me the other day. I'm not a historian, but the New Deal. Right, not the Green New Deal, the New Deal,
yeah,
was a series of small proposals, small and big proposals, stretched over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And collectively, then, they reshaped the economy. That's kind of where we're in, and we're in maybe year one, if you like that analogy. Now, science will tell you You don't have a decade.
Yeah.
You don't have a decade to rework this. But we here we are in that analogy, year one. We have been doing things. We've been doing things, and we want to talk about our agenda and build on things that are working that we've already done in Vermont and we can amplify.
We have 10 minutes to go here, guys. The clock is ticking. Four banner bills, as Sarah Copeland-Hans has called them earlier on this program this morning, and I want to just start with them. We broke them down on the break here. Let's see. Transportation, I think you're going to tackle that one, Christopher Pearson, Senator from Chittenden County. What are we going to do about transportation?
So we're watching the TCI, Transportation Climate Initiative. This builds on the success we've had with REGI, which has been a regional approach to curb emissions on electric production, and has been a discussion between 12 states and governors and their administration from 12 states from Maine to New York down to Virginia, everyone in between, a significant chunk of the country's economy, trying to set up a structure where it's a cap invest in transportation fuels so that we have money coming in to invest in sustainable transportation alternatives in Vermont and approach it in a regional basis so that we're sharing the burden here. This is really challenging for us. Transportation is our biggest single emission producer in Vermont, and we're a rural state, and people need to drive to get to work. So we welcome, I think, the regional strategy to be able to make those investments.
Maybe I should ask a border representative. Is New Hampshire on board?
New Hampshire has been participating. They didn't sign on to the initial memorandum of understanding, but I understand that they have continued to participate, and they will have to come to a decision point at some point in the next year about whether to actually join.
Did they ever get into REGI?
Yes.
They did. It took them a while, right? Weren't they? I thought they were slow to come to the table on that one.
And there were other states that didn't get into REGI initially or got in and backed out, but they are now coming back in. So we're seeing New Jersey and Pennsylvania both knocking on the door of coming back in.
Yeah, I remember in the early days, I thought I remembered New Hampshire being more of an Archie than a REGI. Sorry.
By the way, I ran into Governor Douglas, who got us into REGI the other day, and I asked him, I said, what's your thinking? Does that feel good as part of your legacy? Said, yeah, I think it's been successful. So, and it has been successful. It's kept our electric rates down. And in the region, we have shut down coal and really cleaned up, we got ways to go, but cleaned up a lot of our electric production in terms of emissions.
And so transportation, basically following kind of a similar model here of trying to get these multi-state goals, and everybody who participates and achieves the goals actually ends up reaping some. How does that mechanism actually work?
Well, the details have yet to emerge because all of these governors haven't yet landed on a solution or an agreement.
But, what's suggested?
It's a cap and invest. It would be a cap and invest so that fossil fuel distributors or at sort of upstream where the regional distribution in Springfield, Albany, et cetera, would have a surcharge and also have targets where they're ratcheting down their production. That generates money that comes into the state so we can make investments in things like park and rides and sustainable transportation solutions. One of the things Climate Caucus has been clear about is we want to make sure that money doesn't go to backfill our current transportation budget deficits, like on bridges and roads, but actually is all put towards sustainable transportation solutions.
Okay, building efficiency. Why don't you tackle that one, Sarah Copeland-Hanses?
Yeah, so there are many people, many Vermonters out there who interact with us every single day around our homes and our buildings. You know, if you think about not only the HVAC installer or the contractor, but also, your realtor and your building appraiser. Even bankers and lending institutions. All of these folks are, or many of these folks are licensed by the state of Vermont, registered to conduct their business. And we want to make sure that we're leveraging that point of contact between these professionals and the state to help get information out there to folks so that they are on the front lines and helping Vermonters make more sustainable choices. And so if you think about the challenge of, okay, my furnace just blew and I got to figure out a new heating system, at that point of contact, we want the people that Vermonters are talking to be aware aware of all of the different options, not just I'm going to put another oil boiler in just like the old one. You know, maybe it's time to think about, is my house buttoned up and efficient enough that I could do an air source or even a ground source heat pump system? So this is really about building efficiency is really about connecting with our workforce, investing in that workforce so that there's, you know, training opportunities for the folks who are out there doing this work to, you know, to have a green certification sort of program where we're helping Vermonters access, you know, the most up-to-date information on sustainability around our buildings.
I've thought for a while that if we solve this crisis, it's probably not going to be the environmental NGO lobbyists. It's going to be the electricians and plumbers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And over and over, you find that the solutions actually involve good-paying jobs that you cannot outsource.
Like right? Electricians and plumbers.
That's right. Or the folks that are insulating your home.
Yeah, solar installers. Sure.
There's no way you're exporting that job to China.
That is very, very true. Wow, just 3 minutes left here. Let's go to energy efficiency. Chris.
Sure. We have a 75% requirement for our utilities that in the next 10 years they have 75% of their grid coming from renewable energy. We want to boost that to 100%. We want to also increase the amount of renewable energy that's produced here in state. That, again, is good jobs. It's resiliency. It is security for our grid. And it slows the export of dollars. 100% of our fossil fuel dollars, all of our fossil fuel comes from out of state, so we're exporting those dollars, and too much of our electricity comes from out of state, and so we're exporting some of those dollars. We want to bring those here to strengthen our local economy and resilience and reduce our emissions in terms of electric production.
And then a fourth bill having to do with accountability that you mentioned, Sarah. So holding somebody's feet to the fire, how?
Well, we have had aspirational greenhouse gas reduction targets in statute for a decade, you know, dating back to Governor Douglas. So we've had Democrat and Republican administrations both saying, yes, Vermont needs to reduce its emissions. The problem is those are aspirational. And so what we need to do is we need to pass a Global Warming Solutions Act that will take those aspirations and put them into statute as requirements. And then initiate a structure whereby we can convene state government around how you solve those reduction challenges. And so that's the accountability part that we're looking at, which really will keep Vermont from continuing to blow through our aspirations and will actually demand that the legislature and the administration sit down and figure out how to make it happen.
Yeah, it's sort of like a weight loss program where you get to the end of your first month and you go, well, I promised I was going to lose 10 pounds. It was really only.
But nobody told me I couldn't eat that Twinkie, so yeah. I did.
And you know, Maine and New York recently have passed similar legislation. We want to learn from them, create a system, putting the Paris goals into statute, and then further out a net zero commitment for the state.
All right. Hey, that gets us right to the top of the hour here at the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. I want to thank my guests, Sarah Copeland-Hans, representative from Bradford, and Chris Pearson, senator from Chittenden County. The two of you have been quite informative this morning. Really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Always
all righty. Another fun Friday on the Dave Graham Show. Come back on Monday for even more fun and information and enlightenment and all that sort of good stuff. Folks, have a great weekend out there, and we will talk to you next week.